Hello there. You're listening to the Watson's Daily Podcast with me, Peter Watson, on Wednesday, the 31st of January. Today, I'll be joined by Duncan Balcon, who is a Watson's Daily ambassador. Hi there, Duncan. How are you doing?
Hi, Peter. I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, all good, thank you. So what would you like to talk about today, then, from Watson's Daily?
So, yeah, I've picked a story from the FT, third time in a row this week. So nice. They're obviously doing something right this week.
Third time's a charm.
I know, right. They're standing out to me this week with their Brilliant. With their content. So, yeah, this is a story about Hong Kong bringing in a new security law. So Hong Kong's unveiled proposals for a new national security law that they're saying is going to clamp down on espionage, treason and foreign political influence. So, you know, fairly bold claims that it's going to bring down those three things. But one thing it will definitely do is bring the laws in Hong Kong closer to the laws of mainland China, which I think is quite interesting. So it's going to be in addition to the national security law China actually brought in Hong Kong a few years back, which was in response to anti-government protests. But like I said, the whole thing is just bringing the laws of Hong Kong a lot closer to those laws of mainland China. I think this is interesting. It has been kind of going that way for a while. But this could potentially make doing business in Hong Kong a little bit more difficult. We've seen China recently clamping down on foreign businesses. And it looks like the same thing could start happening in Hong Kong now as a result of this change, which, let's be honest, it's highly likely to get approved. They're proposing it, but let's be honest, the chances are it's going to get approved. And for Hong Kong, which has for quite a while been kind of a global hub, particularly for international businesses and for kind of foreign businesses to the region, it could diminish that status somewhat, I think, and make, particularly for kind of Western companies, which we've seen over the last few years, China is almost proactively trying to discourage from doing business over there. It can make doing business in both China and Hong Kong more difficult. So obviously, slight downside there. But you'd think that the likes of Japan and particularly kind of Singapore and other countries like that in the region could do quite well out of it if businesses wanted to keep their presence in that kind of region. Obviously, they might just go, do you know what, this is too difficult, we're done. But if there are those companies that are I'm thinking tech companies particularly, that really want to maintain a presence in the region, you'd think the likes of Singapore and Japan could do quite well out of this in terms of businesses being based there rather than in Hong Kong, if it's going to be increasingly difficult to do in Hong Kong. So yeah, I just thought really interesting to see another move towards Hong Kong's laws, particularly being similar to mainland China's. What's your take on this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the two are getting close together. I mean, this is inevitable. This is what China's wanted for so long. This is another step towards that. I think that it means, you know, like you're saying, that we saw over last year in particular a clampdown by Chinese authorities on Western companies, and particularly companies like Bain and Company and other consultancy firms, which are used a lot by Western firms to help them with their due diligence when they're thinking of investing in China. So, you know, they become the trusted advisors because they have that local expertise. You know, by having a presence there, they have that local expertise. But China is now saying, look, you know, this is just a front for espionage. So they're clamping down and or kicking them out, or the companies themselves are saying, look, it's just not worth it anymore. So they're pulling out. And what that means is there are fewer companies that are able to provide that service, which means there's probably going to be less investment, or the channels that can be used for investing in China will get much narrower. Now, you know, if Hong Kong is moving towards the same kind of thing, then that is, you know, that's going to make life difficult in Hong Kong if it wants to keep the sort of position that it's had before as being the almost the gateway to that, you know, to Asia. I mean, historically, I suppose the fact that you can function in English there and stuff like that, although you can in other places, but, you know, it, historically, you can function there. But I think, I mean, we saw since the pro-democracy, you know, the aftermath of the pro-democracy movement in sort of at the end of 2019-2020, that a lot of people used that time to reflect and maybe move. I mean, I think that the UK, we did special Hong Kong visas for people that wanted to live over here. And that didn't go down with the Chinese very well. And I think, you know, there will be more of that. I think maybe that's calmed down a bit, but this law may prompt it again. And that's why we might see companies deciding to go and do business in, let's say, Tokyo or Singapore in particular. I mean, I would say, you know, my own impressions with regard to whether you would go to Japan or Singapore, I think that if you don't have experience in Japan, it's particularly problematic, because Japan is not the right word, but it has unique qualities, I think, that make it such that if you don't understand how things are done, you have a really hard time. And, you know, it's been the graveyard of many a foreign firm going over there thinking, yeah, we can do it and we can do it and they will do it on our own, and they don't. And even those who go over there and they partner up with a Japanese firm, it just doesn't work all the time. So I think that if I were, you know, say a Western business looking to go to Asia and wanting to be in a financial hub, I would probably go for Singapore if I'd not had Japanese experience. Yeah. But if I had Japanese experience or Japanese expertise, I would go to Japan, I think. So, but it's very difficult. And all I'm saying is that just this law is going to prompt potentially, you know, Exodus number two. And yeah, it will just get difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you guys have said there, for some companies, and particularly for Kyle, you'd think for Singapore, and I said for those companies, if they do have Japanese expertise, there is opportunity there as well.
Mm.
But just obviously not for businesses that are currently in Hong Kong, because it could get quite difficult, I'd imagine, over the coming months if that law, like, gets approved, like you said in the daily, I think the chances of that are pretty high. So I think companies now already be looking at what plan B is and whether that is an exodus, which it might be.
No, absolutely. And, you know, and I think that the I think that Japan may be doing better in the last year or so, because they historically, Japanese companies are very closed to outsiders, and it's very difficult to do proper, really deep due diligence in many instances. And I think that in the last year or so, that, you know, corporate governance has got better, transparency has improved, and I think sentiment towards Japan generally has improved significantly. I mean, we saw that, I think the Nikkei 225, which I've said before, is not actually what you should be following when you follow Japan, because it's too narrow, it's too focused on old school stuff rather than new tech and software and all that, which is more topics. That's the name of the, you know, that's the name of the index. But anyway, for everyone who doesn't know about Japan follows the Nikkei 225, and that reached, you know, that's reached record levels not seen for 30 years, whatever. So, you know, things like that, things like improved transparency and stuff have really helped. So actually, you know, it may well be, you know, going up in terms of being attractive as a place to do business.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And like I said, you'd imagine that they'll also try and make it more attractive as well if they can.
Yeah.
Because obviously, particularly, they will be aware that other places in the region are making it more difficult to do business there and might sense the opportunity. So I think I just thought I found that really, really interesting, particularly with obviously the ramifications for other countries and companies.
I thought, yeah. I mean, where do you think you would, what would you prefer?
Well, I would probably also go to Singapore because my, well, unless I was taking you with me, because I have very limited experience in Japan. You have quite a lot. So, you know, if we're going to business together over there, I might choose Japan, but by myself, yes, probably Singapore.
Fair enough.
So, yeah, okay. Anyway, so that was my favourite story in today's What's on Sale. What was yours, Peter?
So, mine was about English councils. So this was an article from The Guardian. Actually, they did two articles on this in The Guardian that I saw today, but I only mentioned one of them. So this one was about how, so the background of this is it's all about the councils. It's all about the councils running out of money. Obviously, last year we saw Woking Council, Birmingham Council, you know, essentially going bust. And I forgot what it's called, the local government agency or whatever, saying how there are a lot more councils that could go that way as well. And it seems that the government had been listening to that. Was it a week or so ago? They offered something like £600 million or something, to, you know, extra money, but there's a £4 billion, you know, deficit or something like, anyway, basically there's that going on. So this sounds, at first sight, it looks like it's a good thing, you know. So the ministers are saying, well, why don't you sell off some of your assets? And they estimate these assets, these publicly owned assets, to be worth up to £23 billion. So of course, you know, that would be fantastic.
Quite a sizable amount of money, that, isn't it, as well?
It is. It is indeed. You know, so that would be good. But I think there are a number of problems with that. So I think that the market for these kinds of properties is going to be not optimal at this moment in time. I would imagine that they're not going to be able to get particularly good prices. Secondly, which goes on from the first one, everyone is going to know, if it's a council building, they're going to know that they are forced sellers. So yeah, offers are going to be low. So that is not going to be good either. And I think the other thing as well is it means that, you know, once these assets are sold, that's it. The councils are probably not going to be able to buy them back. So it's okay for now, but what happens if we're in the same situation in the future? So it's a very difficult situation. It sounds like an interesting solution, like, you know, well, why didn't you sell some stuff then? But then I would argue that actually what needs to be done is you need to do an overhaul of how councils are funded, and to make sure that it is government proof, i.e. it doesn't matter who's in government as to how it works. And also, yeah, so I mean that's the main thing, is to make sure that they can survive and have a commitment to increasing the amount that is allocated to them over a specified period of time, and perhaps, you know, review that, like, let's say every 5 years or something. Because the problem is that it would be like trying to put water into a leaky sieve. You can put more water in it, but if there's still massive holes, you're still not going to be able to fill it up. And same here with you know, with the councils. If you're not stopping ways of the money getting out or being wasted or whatever, then or probably, you know, it's the bureaucracy that's involved that slows everything down, which costs money. Then, you know, if you can't solve those things, it doesn't matter how much money you throw at it, you're still going to have problems. So I would say that my preference would be, rather than okay, sell off your family silver, is for the government to actually say, well, look, this is what we're going to do, this is how it's going to work, and, you know, and maybe you could do sell a few things off, but we think that, you know, and but they then come up with a structure that funds that properly funds them. But, you know, the difficulty again there, I mean, I'm sort of debating myself here, but I don't know, I'm just thinking out loud. The problem there is that, you know, it's all very well for everyone to say that the government doesn't give enough money to public services and things, but, you know, when the economy's in a dire state, and obviously governments have to prioritize what they spend their money on, because there are so many different demands in the economy. I think that, you know, that's why the government is elected, to make these difficult decisions. But anyway, ultimately, I think that they have to make these decisions, and, you know, they're going to have to be better funded. But what do you think?
Actually, I think there's a couple of points that you made that I think are really interesting. One is, obviously, whatever solution they come up with, I think, like you said, has to be a solution that works regardless of who's in power. Because I think the worst thing they could do here is put in a solution, councils start getting back on their feet, things start looking better, government changes or local government changes, goalposts get moved, and all of a sudden you're back to square one and all the financial problems will come back because different parties have different views on things. So I think, like I said, that's really important. And secondly, I think I really agree with you in terms of, I'm not sure selling everything off is the right way to go. And I'm assuming quite a lot of these assets are in property. I could be wrong. They haven't really said what they're in. But now, an organisation I used to work for, I'll be very, very careful how I word this, had a brand new purpose-built headquarters building, basically built. Headquarters is probably not the right word, but you know what I mean? Central hub for the business built. And then very quickly realised they couldn't afford it, so sold it off to, you know, for financial stability, like this suggestion is saying, and then ended up renting it back from somebody else. So much as short term it makes you money, if you lose the actual asset, like you said, I think you could find you're financially not better off a few years down the line. Short term influx is great, but actually then at some point having the assets is also quite a valuable thing to have.
Yeah, I mean, that's a classic move. That is a sale and lease back.
Yeah.
You know, that often happens with retailers, for instance. And I think that has happened with M&S, for instance, which maybe, I don't know. This often happens with retailers. So retailers back in the day would own all of their property. And then some financial wizard would come along and go, hey, why are you doing this? You could, you know, you could sell the property, rent it, and then you free up all this massive amount of cash that you can then invest in the business. Doesn't always work, and like you say, you can't always buy the assets back, and it is a tricky one. The thing I was going to say, I think I lost track of what I was going to say earlier, was that with regard to the government getting in, they have to I think I've lost track again, because I mentioned it to you before. I'm trying to think of the point I was saying. That's right. Yeah. So government has to make these difficult decisions, and there's prioritize. And so, but then there's only there's only so much money that is available. And the thing that they can do something about is the public sector, because they are the public sector.
Yeah.
So if, let's say, you know, there's a call to reduce wages or something like that, they can do something with immediately with the public sector because they run it. Whereas they can't, they don't have the same immediate control necessarily of the private sector. So, you know, the when things don't go well in the economy, the public sector often bears the brunt because the government thinks, well, you know, I mean, we spend all this amount on emergency services or the army, you know, the army or, you know, the armed services or something like that. So in order to make our budgets balance, we're going to have to cut here. But of course, you know, you do that and that's not, you know, that then has repercussions as well. So, and so I don't know. I mean, I think that the problem is here is that, you know, they have been underfunded, clearly.
Oh, yeah.
There's probably been incompetence as well, I would imagine. And so, it needs an overhaul. They need more money and there needs to be a way of actually keeping a lid on this rather than just letting it, you know, letting it go and then turning around 10 years later and thinking, hold on, what's gone on here? You know, there needs to be something done about this, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, because it's not a systemic problem, but it's a problem that's been going on for so long. Like I said, that underfunding isn't a new issue. It's going to take a while and so probably quite radical and drastic to change it. I'm just not sure whether selling off all the assets is the way to do that.
Mm. Absolutely. So there we go. So I think we'll leave it there, but but thank you very much indeed for your inputs. I'm going crazy at the moment, but thank you very much indeed. We will be back again, and thank you very much for listening to this as well, for the listeners, and we will be back again to talk more exciting stuff tomorrow. So many thanks
a lot, Peter.
See ya. Bye.